Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, a program where we speak with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Many know Barney Frank as the feisty, witty, intellectually combative congressman from Massachusetts who became the first sitting member of Congress to enter a same-sex marriage. In 1972, he was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives and served 8 years. In the mid-70s, he defended the Combat Zone, Boston's red light district, with a bill to legalize sex for hire in a designated area. Even though it was supported by Boston police, the bill never came up for a vote. Barney Frank represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts for over 30 years. Barney Frank represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts for over 3 decades and chaired the House Financial Services Committee from 2007 to 2011. As a skilled legislator, he played a vital role in AIDS funding in the 80s, as well as sweeping reforms of the U.S. Financial District with the Frank-Dodd Act. In 2010, Frank ran for his 16th and final term. He retired from Congress in January 2013, but his political impact, humorous quips, and rapid-fire speech will continue as he is a regular commentator on MSNBC. Thank you so much, Congressman, for joining me today. Listen, tell me about your childhood, because I've been trying to imagine you as an 11 or 12-year-old. What was your favorite subject, music you liked, that kind of thing?
History was my favorite subject, and I suppose that was a foretelling. I like the story. I like just reading about the political stuff, and history remains today my favorite form of non-business reading because it lets me stick with the subjects I'm interested in, but without any obligation to do anything. And when everybody's dead, you can't feel that,
They need me, huh?
Yeah, exactly. other than that, I grew up, I was... I'm Jewish, and there was a kind of a Jewish community within the working-class community of Bayonne, New Jersey. It was overwhelmingly white. There was one block where black people lived, a couple blocks away from us. So, you know, the schools were integrated, but with a very small black population. I went to a big public high school, so interacted with, you know, the whole range of people. Much of the social activity at that point, we're talking the 40s, the 50s, was confined within the Jewish community. The Jewish Community Center was a place there was a lot of concern that...
And you had your bar mitzvah.
I had my bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of that in the book, flanked by my parents and my Polish-born grandmother, who was looking very much like the peasant, you know, that as she'd grown up. And my father had a truck stop in Jersey City. It was very close. It was just before the Holland Tunnel. I guess the atmosphere, politically and in other ways, that I grew up in part, is best portrayed if people have seen the movie On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, because you had at that point in the air, it was right outside New York City. In fact, the statue, I was born literally 3 miles from the Statue of Liberty, which is actually closer to the New Jersey side. And you had a political machine, a terrible Democratic but very right-wing political machine, that was corrupt and used violence, and they were allied with the mafia and with the Teamsters and Longshoremen's Union at their most corrupt. So you saw a pretty accurate portrayal of much of that in On the Waterfront.
Was your father able to survive there without
becoming a part? He was, with some association. Yeah. For instance, I learned afterwards I hadn't realized the significance of it. My father and his partner ran this truck stop. He and his partner later fell out, and when he died, that was relevant because we were in a difficult situation. And my father had a number of associations with people in the mafia. You know, you're running a business with the truck stop. In fact, there was a rule in New York where you could not drive a truck into New York City, the Teamsters were this strong, without a Teamster in your truck. And actually, in some ways, I found parallels when I first became interested in the civil rights situation in the South. Now, it wasn't as bad.
What do you mean you found parallels?
Parallels in the sense that you had no protection from law enforcement.
Oh.
The way, you know, Emmett Till, which was the first issue that engaged me, was murdered by the local sheriff, and there was nobody you could go to. Now, being white in Jersey City was not anything like the terrible oppression that black people had in Mississippi, but there was in common that law enforcement was corrupt. And so you had to accept the fact that in certain situations, there was no one to protect you against their abuses.
Oh. You just mentioned Emmett Till as one of the reasons that you initially became interested in politics. And also, in your book, you indicated that you used to watch TV Senate hearings, the McCarthy ones.
Then I had a kind of a dual-track life, and I was a normal kid in a lot of ways, and, you know, playing sports and hanging out with the guys and stuff. But I was fascinated, and there were two things. One was the murder of Emmett Till. I was exactly Emmett Till's age, 14, when he was murdered in 1954. Mm. And the notion that law enforcement would beat to death this kid my age and get away with it, and that there was no recourse, that Southern conservatives had so used the filibuster, so there was no law. I said, but this is America. How can it be that you're killed by cops in Mississippi and there's no way to get out of it?
Because they never allowed a law to be passed
they
saying
filibustered
that
they blocked
or
what
whatever.
They scored the lynch laws, mm-hmm. the anti-lynch laws, and mm-hmm. they killed them. They blocked them. We've since done that. You do now have an ability for the federal government to step in if local law enforcement doesn't do it. We've seen that in a number of cases. But then you, so I really was furious. I want to do something about it. And then I watched these Army McCarthy. Joe McCarthy was a terrible bully and a destroyer of people. It's interesting. When he was attacking Harry Truman and the Democrats for being soft on communism, a lot of the Republicans thought that was a pretty good idea. But he couldn't stop. So then when Eisenhower became president, he kept attacking. This time he was attacking Republicans. So they said, well, that's gone too far. So they had these hearings with a very clever lawyer named Joseph Welch. And that, when I was interested in this, and McCarthy was being destroyed, it was almost like fiction. It was a situation where he was a terrible bully, and he ranted, and he was caught in public. And he was forced to just act out and lost all credibility with people. But what got me was, one, Emmett Till made me think, yeah, that's something that needs to be changed. And two, I knew by then I was good at arguing. I've had verbal skills all my life. Other things, I have no, I'm weak on mathematics. I don't have a good musical sense. But I could talk well, and I could argue well. I mean, I knew I could argue well because my teachers would complain to my mother that I was arguing with them too much. And I said, you know, here's the deal. I would like to do something about this kind of terrible racism. And if this is how you do it, by being in these verbal exchanges, then I'd be good at that. So that's really how I decided I'd like to try to be in politics.
Okay, let's play a little bit about everything you ever wanted to know about politics but didn't know to ask. What's the role of luck in politics?
Oh, it's so important. People have this view that there are these, it's men mostly, who at the age of, you know, 14, 15, 16, decide they're going to be governor or president, and they plot and plan, and you have, and then you have some shows that promulgate this, like House of Cards, where here is this very clever man who plots and plans everything. One of my very good friends, a congresswoman, said, you know, there's two, I think House of Cards is just a terrible misrepresentation of reality. He said, it's got two bumps. First of all, we are not nearly that evil. Secondly, we are not nearly that clever. And what I found is Tip O'Neill, great political figure, once told a friend of mine who was feeling guilty because he got elected to Congress because his predecessor had died at the age of 60 from drinking too much, I think. And the guy who died was a friend of O'Neill's, and so this guy, now Senator Ed Markey, said, you know, I really feel bad that I got that job because of what happened to Torby. I mean, his name was Torbert McDonald. And Tip said, Edward, don't worry about it. Don't you understand? We are in a business where you get ahead because of the death, defeat, or disgrace of one of your colleagues. And that works is, the way it works is this. If you want to be a lawyer, a doctor, a teacher, a plumber, a whole lot of other things, a hairstylist, there's probably a job for you. I mean, sometimes or others that might be tight. But if you keep working at it, you'll work as your profession. But if you want to be an elected official, particularly in kind of a full-time job, there are more talented people than places. And so a lot of luck goes into it. Mm-hmm. Because, and it's different in England. In England, they have a system where the political parties can take someone and run that person for parliament anywhere. You don't have, but even though it's not required by the Constitution, there's a very strong localism in America. So if you're not from an area, it's very hard to win. And so what that means is there are a lot of very talented people, but if a vacancy doesn't occur in the area they live in, they don't get a chance to win.
And it's not like they have 100 opportunities.
Exactly,
there are only
right.
two seats.
It's almost like you know, you read these stories about people who get ahead in show business because she was an understudy and the star broke the leg. Well, if the star hadn't broken a leg, et cetera. And in my case, I had gotten elected to the state legislature. I was successful. I was had a good reputation. But being gay, I knew there were only a limited number of places I could run for office. I thought about, well, Congress was just the right level. But I lived in Tip O'Neill's district, so that was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Why would anybody want to run against him? I certainly didn't want to. And so I was getting ready to retire at the age of 40 from elected office, and I was going to be an openly gay advocate and a lawyer, and I would have had some credibility because I'd been in the legislature. And then somebody over whom I obviously had no influence whatsoever made a decision that made it possible for you to run for Congress, Pope John Paul II.
Really?
Well, here's the deal. I couldn't run against Tip O'Neill. There were two districts that were probably mm-hmm. liberal enough for me to mm-hmm. win. The one next to mine, I only lived about 2 miles out of there, so even though moving was a little bit of a problem, but it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't totally foreign to them. It was represented by a Jesuit priest. His name was Robert Drynan. He had been the dean of Boston College Law School. He was a big anti-war activist. And a lot of conservative Catholics at that time in America, this is the late 70s, didn't like the fact that somebody so liberal was in Congress. And in fact, he voted not to ban abortion, although he said personally he thought it was a sin, but he wouldn't impose on others. So Pope John Paul was a tougher guy than his predecessor, Pope Paul VI. So when John Paul II came in, he ordered Father Drynan not to run again. Mm. Now, as a Jesuit priest, Father Drynan had taken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Uh-huh. And he was 60 years old. He'd spent 38 years as a Jesuit. People said, well, why don't you justify him? The answer was, no, this has been my whole life. Plus, he probably would have lost because there would have been this anger at a priest defying that he would have been defrocked. So he stepped aside, and we had about 3 days to scramble, and I jumped into the race. If the Pope had not ordered Father Drynan not to run, my electoral career would have ended 35 years ago. And the one interesting part is that Drynan said he regretted, obviously, two things about this. First, he clearly regretted that the Pope ordered him not to run again. But his second regret, a little less, but not entirely, was that he never got to see the Pope because he said if he did, he was going to say to him, Your Holiness, that business about me not being in Congress, given who succeeded me, did that work out the way you had expected it to? Oh. And we think the answer would have been probably not.
Meaning?
He got a gay Jew, and so not that he's anti-Semitic, but
I don't think
that's what he was looking for.
You are listening to In Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, speaking with Congressman Barney Frank. We'll be back with Congressman Frank after this short break. This is Valerie Jackson back in conversation this evening with Congressman Barney Frank. In 1973, the congressman began his political career when he was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives before going on to serve as a United States congressman for over 30 years. You know, they've basically taken civics classes out of high school curriculums, unfortunately. So just a real brief description as to how the state house, the state House representative, compared or was similar or dissimilar to Congress?
Well, that's a very good question, and I can give an encouraging answer. What I found was at the state legislative level, people who voted, and remember, you know, whenever people are talking about this, I always want to remind them, when you're talking about politicians in America, you got to start with the voters. You know, Congress doesn't exist in a bubble. As Tip O'Neill used to say, nobody ever sat in the House of Representatives who didn't get more votes than anybody else in that last election. Nobody gets appointed there. Occasionally, someone's appointed to the Senate briefly. Even there, it's over 99%. But what I found was when the voters voted for the state legislature, they wanted people who would do their errands. They wanted people who would take care of these kind of mundane issues. And they voted for people who were like themselves. But when they were voting for Congress, foreign policy, the national economy, they did have a sense that this was a harder job. And whether it was on the conservative or liberal side, what I found was that the intellectual level of the U.S. House of Representatives was much higher than it was in the State House of Representatives. An example, Valerie, if there was a very complicated issue that I'd been working on and I wanted to try to explain it in the state legislature, I had to stop and think how to do that in ways that would not be confusing to people. But in the U.S. House, that's not the case. The level of debate can be very high, particularly, I have a criticism of C-SPAN. They show congressional hearings. Well, those are shows. People are performing, trying to look good.
Sometimes to an empty audience.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly, you know, there's this temptation, if you remember the House or the Senate, to attack the person speaking to you. And the reason is, you know, it's gotten worse thanks to the Internet, because think about it. Have you ever turned on YouTube and seen a clip of a senator being nice to anybody? You always see them shaking their fists and what a terrible job you did. That's what, unfortunately, people want to watch. But in the committee meetings where we actually vote on the bills, they're called markups because they literally, you take a bill and you say, on page 7, line 14, strike out this word and put in that word. I wish people could see, because the level of discussion there is very intelligent. So the people in Congress have been much more serious. Unfortunately, I'm describing something that went up to like about 2010. This may sound partisan, but it's reality. When the Tea Party took over, the Republican Party, you have now a larger number of members of Congress who really have deviated from that. All they have is their ideology, and they're not interested in give and take and conversation. And people say, oh, Congress is broken down. It's not. It's the Republicans did it. I will cite some evidence here. You showed me that book I was glad to see from Henry Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury under Bush. And I gave the book, I will be honest with you, while you were getting ready, I gave that book what we call a Washington read. Do you know what that is? You go to the index and look for your name. I did that. I'm on page 220. While you were there, I went and looked myself up in the index. In Hank Paulson's book, and he talks. I was very proud about an incident where there was a Chinese American who lived in my district who'd gotten himself in trouble in China, and his had a wife and small kids, and people were making a big public issue about it. It wasn't working, so Paulson had gotten very close to the Chinese, so I asked him if he could get the guy out, and he did. But he mentions in there that he told the Chinese government that he wanted them to let this man out, Yang Jianli, as a favor to him. The Chinese wanted to be nice to Paulson. He was important to them. And he basically said, look, this man who's asked me to do this, this congressman, is very important to me. He's chairman of this committee that I have to deal with. So it would be very helpful to me if you will let his guy out. And I cite that because it shows the working relationship I had with George Bush's Secretary of the Treasury. And the tragedy is, and this is just overwhelmingly the fact, you talk to, you know, any of your local people, when George Bush was president and there was this crisis late in his term, he got great cooperation from the Democrats. And then when Barack Obama came in, he got none whatever from the Republicans.
One of the things you mentioned in your book was how too often we or politicians or groups reject partial victories.
Absolutely.
Talk about that a moment.
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned, I wish, and I had this argument particularly with lesbian and gay people, and they would misquote African-American history. Well, Martin Luther King never compromised. Valerie, I wish we were on television now and I had a camera, because I wish all of my lesbian and gay allies could see the look on your face of disbelief when I talked about it. In fact, well, that was part of his greatness. He was a man who was so deeply morally passionate. And he understood that, and I've said this to people, and Dr. King exemplifies it. Yes, it's important to be idealistic. You start with your ideals. But if you don't think hard about how to implement your ideals, what good are they? They make you feel morally superior, but they don't help any kid or older person or clean up an environment. And Martin Luther King, as you know, constantly looked at the landscape, said, here's our goals. What are the obstacles? How do I do it? And as I said, in the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall, the first lawsuits they brought against Separate But Equal were not asking that Separate But Equal be thrown out altogether. First, they wanted to show that it was impossible to achieve. In fact, they weakened it. And they said, well, you said Separate But Equal, but it's never equal, so let's get rid of it. But first, they had to go through that. And this is what I have argued to people. And it's something they forget. Well, why can't we just, you know, overcome this right away? Well, the very fact that something bad exists in a society as complicated as ours means it has strength. Things don't just float down, and you have to be thoughtful about how to do it. And the notion is, I'm not going to accept anything until I get everything, is a good way to never get anything. And the other thing you do is you discourage your own people. If you tell them, you know, this doesn't count, we got this victory, that victory, that's no good. I have an argument now with some LGBT people who say the next gay rights bill should cover everything, just like the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which didn't cover everything. It didn't cover voting rights, which was 65. It didn't cover fair housing until 68. If you insist on getting it all at once, you probably don't get anything.
Now, in 1972, you considered, was the first time you seriously considered running for office, but you really weren't ready for the gay thing, you know, the gay question, are you gay, because you were still in the closet. What did the argument inside your head sound like?
Oh, very good question. And you, by the way, you referred to this. I thought about it as the gay thing, and it was this thing that was there that I had to confront. I made two choices. First of all, I learned by then that I was good at politics, much better at politics than at scholarship, which was the alternative. I'm just
never got that PhD, huh?
No, and I said, you know, look, the career advice you give young people. Know yourself. Know what your strengths and your weaknesses are, and try to go somewhere where you have strengths and not weaknesses. And in my case, I have one characteristic, the same characteristic, which was a terrible weakness when I wanted to be a scholar and write a PhD thesis, but very important to be in the political situation. And I'm serious. I have a short attention span, so that, you know, if you're a congressman or you're the mayor's assistant, well, how many times a day would Maynard have to change directions in what he was thinking about? You know, it's just, if you had a half hour to deal with something, that was a luxury,
right,
as opposed to a scholar who will spend weeks on a particular issue. And we need both. I don't mean to say one is better than the other. Society needs both. I just realized I was better at the kind of, all right, you know, let it come at me and let me work with it. And then I had a chance to run for office in this somewhat atypical part of Boston, which was... Boston was a pretty provincial place. I didn't live there very long. But this was downtown Boston, a lot of younger people who were highly educated. I mean, I'd gone to Harvard, and much of Boston at that time, that was a handicap. People didn't like Harvard, but in this neighborhood, it was helpful. So I decided I could run for office, and I literally had that conversation with myself that you asked me about, and I decided two things. First of all, I would be a coward, by which I meant I wanted to be in public office. Partly, obviously, for ego and because I thought I would be good at it. Also, I like to think because that was a place, an elected official, where I could do things like help get a state senate district that did not discriminate against African Americans or push for economic fairness, et cetera. But I knew that if I announced that I was gay, I couldn't win. This is 1972. I mean, that's a long way before people were ready to accept us. And so I said, okay, I'll sacrifice. I won't be honest about who I am. On the other hand, and this is a very important decision as well, I will never be a hypocrite. I will never be one of those gay people who lives a gay life privately but votes for anti-gay stuff. I think that is just absolutely despicable. When you have a certain lifestyle yourself and then you punish other people like yourself. So that was what I thought. And I thought, okay, here's the deal. At first, I thought, well, I won't have much of a private life. My career will be a substitute. And people have said, you know, you have a great career, and my career was doing well. You don't need a private life. Well, I found that to be the opposite of the truth. Mm-hmm. I found that as I became more prominent, as I was being invited to places and celebrations and parties, including with a lot of gay people, because I was the lead sponsor of the Gay Rights Bill, the contrast between that and a very sad personal life just made it worse. You know, you go to this big event and everybody's cheering you, and then you go home alone.
Right.
So
right.
I ultimately decided this isn't going to work, and I'm going to have to be honest about it.
Well, there's a quote in the book. The strain of living in the closet takes a heavy toll on your personality.
Absolutely.
How did it impact your personality, being in the closet?
I've seen this
in
other people. It makes you mean. You know, you.
We so that's all why have, you're so ornery.
Well, we all have these. You know, look, I think being ornery can be useful if you're ornery for a purpose, right, but if not, if it was too much.
Misdirected anger,
yeah, absolutely,
at yourself.
And, well, you know, that's the worst kind of anger, Val. When you're angry at yourself, it's the worst, because you have nobody else to blame. If you're angry at some other person, at least you can, you know, think in your head how terrible he or she is. But when you're mad at yourself, that anger has nowhere to go but to turn in on you. And what happened is this. I'll give you an example. When it was when I was about to come out, there were rumors in 1987 when I decided I would volunteer that I was gay. Some of the most pro-LGBT people in America came to me and said, "Yeah, probably you shouldn't do that." There was a counselor named Mickey Leland who was a great.
I know Mickey.
Yeah, Mickey was a crusader against hunger. He was killed in a plane crash in Africa when he was over there doing good. Other people said, "Well, you know, man, maybe you shouldn't do that, because." These were other liberal congressmen. They said, "You're our ally. You work with us on a whole lot of issues. If you announce that you're gay, maybe people will only want to hear about you from gay rights stuff, and so we will lose you as a full-time ally." My answer was, "Well, that may be true. I don't know that it's wrong. I hope it is, but I can't live this way anymore." But after I came out, and this is what's relevant to your question, some of them came to me and said, "Well, we're glad you did it. You were right, because you're nicer now." And, you know, being a legislator has a lot to do with interacting with other people. And, you know, being able to have strong views, but still get along with people. And that's what John Lewis is, just such, right, an extraordinary, right, example of absolute, complete passion for his ideals, and is the nicest man in the world.
You were a big supporter of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There was a quote, another quote in your book that I had to write down. A young military man said, "When I was in the military, they gave me a medal for killing two men and a discharge for loving one."
Yeah.
Woo!
That was very powerful. And I worked very hard. In fact, I misjudged that politically. In 1991, Bill Clinton was looking to run for president. He was running. And he wanted to get liberal support. And there was a good friend of mine in Congress named Tom Downey. He was a congressman from Long Island who had worked with Clinton on welfare issues. So Clinton asked him to get a group of liberals, meet with him off the record. And we did. And I said, "Look, one of the things I'd been interested in was this policy in which gay people could not serve openly in the military." And actually, I had a gay colleague, Gary Studs, who'd been working on that, and the two of us. And, you know, we were encouraged we could go after it, because the RAND Corporation, which was this big think tank, had said the policy made no sense. And I'd scored a blow for that. I was on the House Budget Committee when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense. And he came and he testified. And I ambushed the Secretary of Defense very successfully. Dick Cheney had a gay assistant secretary in the Defense Department who's now out. The man's name is Pete Williams. People will know him as a very good TV journalist. And he worked for Cheney, was from Wyoming, and he was gay and closeted. So I asked Cheney whether the reason for excluding gays from the military was that we were considered security risks, which was one of the arguments. And he was obviously in a dilemma, because if he said, "Yes, gay people are security risks," then some journalist is going to say, "Forget about privacy. You have a gay press secretary. So if he's a security risk, what are you telling him for?" So Cheney, I mean, it got to one of these almost like a Danny Kaye Patterson. I knew that Cheney's press secretary was gay. Cheney knew that I knew. I knew that he knew that I knew. And so what's he going to do? And I asked him the question, and he responded in a way that helped. He said, "Oh, no, Congressman, that's just an old chestnut." And I was delighted with that, because he undermined the whole security clearance thing. By the way, Eisenhower in 54 had said gay people could never get a security clearance. Bill Clinton in 95 got rid of that, and that was helpful because he could cite Cheney. But so we were ready to get rid of this, and I thought it might be sort of easy. And we were analogizing it, obviously, to Harry Truman doing away with segregation in the armed forces. So I was actually just reading a good biography by Doris Kearns about Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt during World War II, mm-hmm. and about her efforts to make the Navy integrate mm-hmm. in the vicious racism of the Navy, the United States Navy, ironically fighting Hitler and fighting against this and insisting on segregation. But I asked Clinton if he would agree to get rid of that. He said, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. And so we expected it to go. But then when he got elected and he said he was going to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, first Senator Dole decided this would be a good issue. But we then got ambushed by a Georgian. Sam Nunn, for some reason, led the fight with a great ferocity against letting gays into the military. Now, I know he later, with his daughter running, retracted that, but Sam Nunn did enormous damage to us at that point. He was chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He had more hearings about gay men taking showers than he did about NATO.
Well, let's move on to the Frank Dodd Amendment. Okay, your namesake. Now, let me back up for those who may not know what the Frank Dodd Amendment
is. What happened, of course, is that in 2008, the financial system collapses, and it was because there were no rules, no regulations. Here's the problem. Under Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, America adopted a lot of rules to govern the financial community, Securities and Exchange Commission and things. Over the next 50 years, they became outdated because the community, the business community, came up with new things. There was all this information technology, so they had all these complicated derivatives and credit default swaps and collateralized loan obligations, things that didn't exist the last time the rules were passed. So it caused terrible problems. I'll give people an example. In 2008, a major international insurance company, the American International Group, but based in America,
AIG,
came to the federal government and said, we owe $85 billion that we promised to pay people in financial insurance, and we don't have it. And of course, this is the Bush administration now. What they said is, okay, if they can't pay their $85 billion, then all the people they owe the money to won't be able to pay their people, and pretty soon
won't be able to pay that taxes.
And then it turned out a week later that AIG came in and said, oh, no, we were wrong. It wasn't $85 billion. It was $170 billion. So here's this major corporation alone that owed $170 billion that it couldn't pay. The reason is that that's because of derivatives, where you put up a few bucks, but there's multiples of that behind. So we had to come up with a way to stop these things from happening in the future. And that was the financial reform bill. And basically what we said to businesses, look, we still want you to take risks, but you have to stand behind your risks. You can't promise something. You better have the money to pay for it. And it worked ironically there with, not ironically, on the partisan thing, with Secretary Paulson. The day that we announced we were going to do this, March the 9th, The Dow Jones Industrial Average in the stock market was 6,500. It's now 18,000. Well, if the stock market can go up 300% in a 6-year period, that's pretty good. And I think from people on the left said, well, it wasn't very effective. The Huffington Post, which is a very good progressive operation, they had a front page story last Friday that made me very proud. GE, the old General Electric, had gone away from just manufacturing things, and they'd gone into the financial side of things, and they had this massive, complicated financial thing. And last Friday, they announced they were selling it because it's gotten too hard to make money thanks to our rules, which is fine. I would rather them be making things, because a lot of that financial stuff was just manipulation and trading for their own benefit. So I think it's held up quite well.
So what do you think it was the biggest, or is maybe still the biggest, misconception that people have about the bill?
Well, one is that it's hurting smaller banks. In fact, there's very little in there about smaller banks. The only thing that's in there that I think some of the smaller banks complain about is it has said that these loans, we call them predatory loans, that were made to people that got them into big trouble can't be made anymore. But then there's this view on the left that it doesn't really do anything because it didn't break up the banks. It did not break up the banks, but it put real limits on what they can do, so that some of them are kind of like GE, gonna sell off parts of them themselves. Mm. I think it has made it less likely that we have a terrible crash. Now, there is, and the Republicans say, oh, well, it's bad for small banks, but that's not really what they care about. The one amendment they got through, and the president signed it, and because they made it part of a larger bill, I don't think he'll do that again, It had to do with financial derivatives, and it was mostly in the interest of Citicorp. Well, when you're doing things for Citicorp in Manhattan, it's kind of hard to say that you're really out there just for the little neighborhood banks. The other thing they hate very much was something that was pushed by Senator Elizabeth Warren, which is the Independent Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's already saved consumers billions of dollars in credit cards. Here's the way it used to work. Every banking law had some consumer protections in it, but they were all administered by the agencies that were there to help the banks. The Federal Reserve System, which I think does a good job, but I don't think anybody thinks of it as your friendly neighborhood consumer watcher. Most of the consumer laws in America, more than any other, were administered by them. So what Elizabeth Warren said is, well, let's take all the laws to protect consumers, let's toughen them up, and put them in a separate agency whose only job is to protect the consumers. In fact, it's called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And we put that in there. And by the way, I have a story which I like to tell, because sometimes I worry that, you know, some of the people I'd like to see vote don't vote. They get discouraged. I mean, that's what happened in 2014. People voted for President Obama in 12, didn't turn against him. They just didn't vote the last time around. So the day the committee I chaired passed the bill as part of the overall financial reform bill to set up this Independent Consumer Bureau, the press said to Elizabeth Warren, do you have a comment? She said, yeah. They told me not even to try this because the banks always win. But they didn't win today. And they didn't win that day because people spoke out to their legislators. So, but here's the deal on the bill. I think it's in good shape now, but it's up for grabs. In 2016, we're going to have a presidential election. If the Republicans win, they will repeal it. If the Republicans win, that'll be the end of climate change. You know, there are going to be some very important issues on the ballot in 2016.
We'll be back after this short break and continue our conversation with retired Congressman and author Bonnie Frank. His latest book is an autobiography entitled Frank. Welcome back. This is your host, Valerie Jackson. Joining me in the studio this evening in conversation is former Congressman Bonnie Frank. In the next segment, Frank talks about grassroots political movements, the importance of voting, and legislation that may best represent the needs of Americans. Your new book, Frank, is a personal history of a sharp drop in prejudice against LGBT people, but it's also about a sharp increase in anti-government opinion of people who are resistant to working and coming together through government to improve their lives. How did this happen? When did it start, this anti-government sentiment?
Again, your questions are the ones that help me make these points that I think are relevant. By the way, and I'm glad you juxtaposed those, because there was a view a few years ago that the reason a lot of white working-class men, the kind of people who would have voted for Harry Truman or Franklin Roosevelt, that the reason they wouldn't vote for Democrats anymore is that the Democrats had gotten too much into these social issues about, you know, gays, et cetera. Well, if you look at it, support for gay rights, for same-sex marriage, has been going up while this anger of the Democrats has been going down. So it's kind of hard to argue that was the cause. I think it has to do with the economy. You know, in the period right after World War II, up into the 80s, America dominated the world because everybody else had been destroyed by World War II. So, you know, you remember, you in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, if you were a white guy, because if you were black or a woman, you suffered prejudice. But if you were a white guy, you could get a good construction job or you could go into a factory. You didn't have to have an advanced degree. You didn't have to have some special intellectual, technical skills. If you were willing to work hard, you made a good living. Well, what happened is that turned against America. That is, the kind of products which that turned out started to be made elsewhere. to make a good living in America, more and more you need an advanced degree and specialized skills. And so you have people today who look back to the 70s and 80s and say, well, how come my economic position hasn't advanced? Why am I not as well off as my father? And I think that's a fair question. And I think, ironically, these are people who, they're not against the government in principle. They blame the government because the government has sat by while their economic position deteriorated. But then you get into a vicious cycle. Because they blame the government for not helping them, then they vote for people who denounce the government. And so when people who denounce the government get in, then things we could do that to help them get cut back. That's why my view is that if we could find the resources to make higher education financially accessible for working class people, if we could put all the construction people to work and hire some new ones so we could build the roads and the bridges that we need and new buildings, that would help people's economy. I would like, instead of cutting back on things like Medicare and Social Security, frankly, I think Medicare ought to start at 55 instead of 65. That's a great burden off people from economic insecurity. If we could do those things, I think many of the people who are mad at government would say, well, no, that's a pretty good idea. Now that would reverse this trend to greater inequality. So then the question is, okay, but how can you do that without the money? And that's why I have two proposals. First of all, I believe we are way overextended in defending the whole world. Look at Western Europe. We went to help them in 1947. They were poor and devastated. Today, the Western European nations are the economic equivalent of America in every case but one, their military budgets. They don't spend any money on their military.
Because we're doing it for them.
We're doing it for them. So they can spend the money on education and health care and social services. And it's time to say we could save tens of billions of dollars if Europe just took care of itself. We still have, look, the terrorists are terrible people. And I cheer when one of them is killed, to be honest. But you don't defeat the terrorists with some of these super expensive nuclear weapons. You know, our problems in Iraq and Afghanistan had nothing to do with the lack of weapons. It had to do with the political situation. So I believe we could, if we said to the rest of the world, look, we'll still be there to help out some, but we're not in charge of everybody everywhere every time. You would save a lot of money. And the other issue, maybe a little more controversial to some people, I would stop prosecuting people for the use of recreational drugs. If they are not things that make you hurt other people. I think this war on drugs has done great harm, and there's a new good reason for it. I think people now understand this. We have made great progress in abolishing racism legally, but it's still around in our society, and these latest... And so where have we seen the most recent outbursts of racism? In law enforcement. It is in law enforcement as it's carried out. And where it is this, as I see it. I don't think we see much discrimination in the enforcement of the laws against murder or armed robbery. If it's a serious crime, then the society tends to go after it. But we have these laws on the books that treat as criminal things that aren't really criminal, that aren't really bad things. And those become a vehicle for racism. And I believe that the application, let's take marijuana. I believe the application of the criminal sanctions against smoking marijuana are the place where racism in America manifests itself most. You look at the arrest records for who gets arrested for marijuana. Now a lot of rich kids are smoking marijuana, rich white kids. They don't get arrested. Similarly, by the way, you saw this with cocaine, where
the crack versus the powder.
And this enormous disparity. Now, you know, look, I wish nobody took drugs. I wish nobody did a lot of things. But in a free society, some things have to happen. But we waste a lot of money now, police, courts, prisons. How many people are in prison? I mean, if we stop prosecuting people for drug use, yeah, I want people locked up who do bad things to other people. We would then free up the money to make education available, to extend Medicare so that you take some of that burden off people and do all these other things that would make people feel good about government again.
You know, many people feel that government is not responding, is not listening to them, but yet I think part of it might be the problem of the voter or the citizen, because we're not going about it the right way to let these elected officials know what we need and what we want.
Well, in particular, look, I have to say, somebody said you're kind of critical of your side, the liberal side. Yeah, on substance, I argue with the conservatives, but on procedure and methods, I argue with people on my side. And by the way, you know, again, people have this mistaken, monolithic view of the civil rights movement. I can remember when the SNCC people used to make fun of Dr. King. Mm-hmm. They used to call him DeLord from Green Pastures. because they didn't think he was militant enough. Well, he was very militant. I think he was just more sensible about how you do it. And I have this problem with my friends on the left. When people on the right get angry about something politically, they go out and vote. When people on the left get angry, they march. Voting beats marching. Compare Occupy and the Tea Party. I wish the Tea Party hadn't been so influential, and I wish Occupy, I didn't agree with everything, had been more influential. But having drum circles doesn't do much to affect public policy.
You've got to call that elected official.
Absolutely.
You've got to write them, email them, whatever. But you've got to be...
And get people registered to vote.
You have to have action on it.
You know, I was encouraged to see that message seems to have gotten across in Ferguson. So that there was still only a 30% turnout, but at least they got some people elected, and I think that'll make some changes in law enforcement there.
You remind me of something former Morehouse President Benjamin E. Mays said. He was one of the Morehouse's greatest presidents, and he would always say, if you believe in something, you must act on it. If you don't act on it, it's not a belief, it's an opinion.
I agree with that, and it's an indulgence. I mean, you have no right to feel morally superior because you're in favor of this or that if you haven't done a darn thing to put it into effect.
All right, sir, we're unfortunately running out of time, but I've got to ask you about this. Hillary Clinton running for president. What do you think the
chances are? I'm a strong supporter, and I want to address one thing. People sometimes make something out of nothing and then it builds on it. You hear this, oh, I don't want Hillary Clinton with all these controversies. I just want to make one thing clear, because they come up the email. There she goes again. Well, in the first place, no voter has told me they care who used what email where. If something came out where she said something bad, then that's one thing. But here's the deal about, there's another thing with Hillary Clinton. I was on the House Bank Committee when they began under the Republicans to investigate Whitewater. And I was on the House Judiciary Committee when we dealt with the impeachment. And I can tell you this. There was Whitewater, there was the FBI files, there was the travel office, the murder of Vince Foster, God knows what else. All these accusations, not one thing was ever proven. There's no negative about Hillary Clinton. I asked Kenneth Starr, who was the guy trying to get the Clintons after the election when he had to testify, and the only thing he found that was wrong in all of his investigations was the president's activity with Monica Lewinsky, which you could hardly blame on Hillary. But all these other accusations against Hillary had no basis whatever. I think she's a smart, able person. And to my friends on the left, I do not understand. I think some of us have this problem where we consider ourselves to be the leaders, and if we're in the majority, we're uncomfortable. I think Hillary will be a defender of financial reform, of health care, going forward on climate change, keeping tax rates for the very wealthy where they are rather than reduce them. I'm enthused.
So what's going to be your role as a private citizen? Ha ha.
Well, one thing, look, I came to this late with my own repression, I mean, but I'm happily married and enjoying a part of life that I waited too long for, but all the more reason to do it now. And I get to speak out, and I get to speak out on things I want to talk about. And nobody can come to me and say, you have to deal with this issue. I said, no, that's not an issue. It's not a high priority for me. So I've written the book, and I'm getting to talk about it, like on the show. I write a column for a paper in Portland, Maine, and I give speeches, and I do some television, MSNBC and CNBC. But other than that, I take it easy.
So what do you think might be the most pressing issue or legislative issue to Congress right now?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. Reducing this overextension of America's military presence throughout the world, because as long as we do this, we will not be able to adequately deal with quality of life issues here at home or overseas. Yeah, I don't like the idea that we have children starving to death in various parts of the world, but we spend so much money on the military that we don't have the resources to help them.
Who's your favorite Republican?
Over time, Senator Alan Simpson, retired Senator Alan Simpson, was a guy that I was able to work with very well. He all time I demand he just died. I publicly campaigned for him as a Republican senator, even though I was a Democrat. And that's former Senator Ed Brooke from Massachusetts.
Oh yes, good guy. So how is your successor Joseph Kennedy III doing?
Very well. He's I give him a lot of credit. You know, he's got all these family connections, and legislating is very jealous. I've always said, being successful in legislature is kind of like being popular in high school. You got to be careful that you don't, you know. And Joe is—he's a friend to people. He goes and campaigns for other people because he has that prominence. But he's a very relaxed, low-key guy. I hear very good things about the impression he's making on people, and he's very serious about his job.
So, what do you think was your most important piece of work in Congress?
Well, obviously, the financial reform bill had a major role, but that one was kind of defensive. Mm-hmm. When I got to Congress, there were, you know, we couldn't serve in the military, and you couldn't become to America as a gay immigrant, and you couldn't get a security clearance. Well, that was in the immigration law, and I was able to get rid of all of those. But the other one that I worked on the hardest, and I have been a longtime advocate of building rental housing for low-income people. Instead of putting them into homes that they can't afford, build decent rental housing and alleviate the housing crisis. And I've been working on that. I worked on that for all 32 years.
You know, but there was a lot of confusion on that issue because, you know, there's a certain jargon. You know, and you, when you said, I believe, when you were presenting the bill and you said affordable housing, people automatically assumed that you meant buying a house, but you were talking about rental
properties. Well, that's right. It's a good lesson to us to not speak in insider jargon. People who are active in housing have always known we've made a distinction between low-income home ownership and affordable housing, which meant rental housing. And in fact, I have been very critical of these efforts to push people into home ownership when they didn't really have the economics to do it. And you know, as you know, it's not good enough just to have enough money to make the to make it if everything goes right. Because particularly when you're buying an old house, everything doesn't go right. And so people get in trouble because there are these other expenses and there's nothing in their budgets for them. And I'm very pleased. One of the people I work with closely was former Congressman Mel Watt from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the people who urged the president to make him the head of the Federal Housing Finance Administration. And one of the things he did earlier this year was to promulgate a rule to put into effect something that was in a bill that I'd worked on, the Low-Income Housing Trust Fund. So hundreds of millions of dollars a year are now available to build affordable rental housing. And, you know, after 10 years, you'll have a lot of units built by that.
Congressman, thank you so very much for sharing this time with us today.
I've
really enjoyed it.
Thank you. This is a good conversation.
Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Lois Reitzis and Dave Barraswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. Good night.